Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Sounds and Sights of Cinema here on WHIE Radio and DVDVerdict.com. I'm your host, Clark Douglas. Later on in the show, we'll check out some highly acclaimed films, which are getting a lot of Oscar buzz at the moment. We'll be looking in on Steven Spielberg's pair of new movies, The Adventures of Tintin and War Horse, plus David Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method and Thomas Alfredson's Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. The star of that last film is Mr. Gary Oldman, and we're going to be featuring music from film starring Gary Oldman on the program today. We're going to begin with a really wonderfully atmospheric and moody piece from composer Wojciech Kilar, written for Francis Ford Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula. Take a listen.
Thank you.
music from Bram Stoker's Dracula by Wojciech Kilar. People have varied opinions on that movie, but the soundtrack is certainly excellent. A wonderful piece of music there. We continue now with an atypical score from composer Hans Zimmer, a surprisingly cheerful score with an oddly Jamaican flavor written for Tony Scott's crime thriller True Romance. Take a listen. Nice music written for True Romance. That's a piece that's been mimicked and ripped off I don't know how many times in various other movies and TV shows and television commercials and so on. But a distinctive score, certainly, and that was a very interesting part for Gary Oldman, too. A small role, but a very colorful one that left a big impression on a lot of people. Next up, we move along to a score from composer Mark Isham, written for a crime movie called Romeo is Bleeding.
Thank you.
music from Mark Isham, written for the movie Romeo is Bleeding. Isham incorporates jazz into his film music about as well as anyone working today. Next up, another composer who actually incorporates jazz quite well into many of his film scores, though not this one. Christopher Young provides music for a movie called Murder in the First. Take a listen. Music for Murder in the First, another potent reminder of what an underrated composer Christopher Young is. Next up, we have a lovely score from Mr. John Barry, written for a much-loathed movie called The Scarlet Letter. Let's take a listen. Thank you. John Barry's score for the adaptation of Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter, one of the only good things about that movie. Next up, a fun score from composer Jerry Goldsmith, written for a film in which Gary Oldman played a very colorful villain. It's Air Force One. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Sounds and Sights of Cinema here on WHIE Radio and DVDVerdict.com. I'm your host, Clark Douglas, and we're spotlighting music from the films of actor Gary Oldman on the program today. I do hope you've enjoyed what we've featured thus far, and that you'll continue to enjoy what we have to offer in the second half of the program. Next up, we move to a score from composer Bruce Broughton for another critically panned film called Lost in Space, in which Oldman played yet another villainous character. Let's take a listen. Music by Bruce Broughton, written for Lost in Space. One of the best roles that Oldman has been given in the last decade is the role of Jim Gordon in Christopher Nolan's Batman movies, and we're going to feature now a piece co-written by Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard from The Dark Knight. Enjoy. Thank you. Music from The Dark Knight by Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard. Moving from the sublime to the ridiculous, music by Ramin Djawadi, written for a lesser film that Mr. Oldman starred in recent years called The Unborn. This main title piece is kind of catchy, though. Let's take a listen. Music from The Unborn, written by Ramin Djawadi. Last but not least, we move to the great Alberto Iglesias and his score for the new movie that we're reviewing in just a few short moments, Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Take a listen. Thank you. Music by Alberto Iglesias, written for Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. We have reviews of four recently released movies on the program today, and I'll just be honest with you up front, they're all great movies, so I'm going to have some rather positive things to say about all of them. It's just the way it worked out. I feel almost a little embarrassed giving rave reviews to every movie I'm reviewing this week, but they're all just that good. So we move along and begin with Steven Spielberg's The Adventures of Tintin. And among its many other accomplishments, The Adventures of Tintin serves as a sharp reminder that our present-day golden age of animation has only begun to tap into the medium's potential. There are breathtaking shots and scene transitions in Tintin which gleefully inform the audience, since it's animated, we can pretty much do anything we want. The movie is an adaptation of the popular comics by the beloved French artist Herge, whose sense of whimsy hasn't been diluted by Spielberg's delightfully frantic, idiosyncratic picture. Like Spielberg's Indiana Jones movies, the film is largely a callback to Adventures of Yesteryear. The comical manner in which it treats alcoholism is definitely a charming relic of the past, which transcends its inspirations with the aid of cutting-edge modern technology. It's just about as much fun as an indie adventure, too, though it's quite possibly the most weightless film Spielberg has directed to date. Even 1941 had more heft than Tintin. That's not an insult, just a basic description. Tintin is designed to be an easily digested popcorn flick, brimming over with grand jokes, colorful supporting characters, and sweeping action set pieces. The only quibble I have with it is that the title character is disappointingly thin. Jamie Bell's Tintin is a generic leading man, good-looking, well-mannered, resourceful, and energetic, who is generally shoved off the screen by any supporting players he encounters, particularly Andy Serkis's delightful Captain Haddock, who eventually claims the movie for his own. That issue aside, The Adventures of Tintin is another of Spielberg's consummate entertainments. Most of director David Cronenberg's films have been centered around moments in which characters begin pushing boundaries and soon find themselves facing severe moral dilemmas. Consider Jeff Goldblum's experimental scientist in The Fly, Jennifer Jason Leigh's computer programmer in Existenz, numerous characters in Crash, James Wood's television programmer in Videodrome, Viggo Mortensen's ordinary family man in A History of Violence, the list goes on. Because of its lack of extreme violence or bizarre imagery, many have suggested that David Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method just doesn't feel remotely Cronenbergian, or Cronenbergundian, as he prefers. Nonsense. The director's comparatively low-key chamber drama is yet another fascinating exploration of his pet themes, as he examines a clash of ideas between two men still regarded as titans in the strange field of psychiatry. The intellectual battles are fought between Michael Fassbender's Carl Jung and Viggo Mortensen's Sigmund Freud. These are fascinating moments fueled by sterling performances and impressively nuanced dialogue, but there are many moments of surprising contrast between the drama which plays out in the medical journals and the drama which plays out in real life. The personal lives of Freud and Jung arguably contradict or at least complicate their official positions on psychiatric subjects, a notion Cronenberg illuminates in subtle, compelling fashion. The heart of the film is formed in the relationship between Jung and his tormented yet intelligent patient, Sabina Spielheim, played by Keira Knightley, who's rarely been better, a relationship which shifts uneasily from professional to personal, while turning sticky, sweet, and strained at various points along the way. Cronenberg's film has a great many things to say, and it's a vastly more effective biopic of the three central individuals it features than a more conventional narrative would have been. But the one which really lingers is this. Most truly inspired discoveries are ones which lead the discoverer to understand just how far they are from actually understanding anything. Throughout Steven Spielberg's War Horse, there were moments in which I began to grit my teeth and prepare myself for the worst. Okay, I would think to myself, this upcoming scene has been telegraphed to death, and I know exactly how it's going to play out and what sort of emotions it will attempt to inspire. Then the movie would proceed to play out more or less as I had envisioned, and I couldn't stop the tears from rolling down my face. There's no question that War Horse is a film which wears its heart on its sleeve, but Steven Spielberg's achingly sincere direction once again elevates material which might have seemed cheap in lesser hands. As with Schindler's List and The Color Purple, we aren't brought to tears by horrific tragedy, but rather by moments of goodness and humanity in the midst of that tragedy. War Horse uses its title character as a vehicle through which we witness the worst and best of humanity, the presence of the innocent beast in Smire's small-scale dramas which make human conflict of all sorts seem petty, whether it's one country going to war against another or a poor farmer locked in a struggle with his landlord. Time after time, the director goes for broke and succeeds against all odds, particularly in a concluding series of shots, which distinctively recall the warm, dusky, sprawling vistas of John Ford. In fact, Ford's influence can be felt all over the place, delivering a humanist fable which once again reminds us that Spielberg is unparalleled when it comes to finding truthful, resonant hope in the midst of horror. And finally, though Thomas Alfredson's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy won a great deal of acclaim, there's one common complaint that I'd like to address. The notion that the movie is too confusing. Alfredson's adaptation of John le Carré's great spy novel is an intentionally disorienting experience that flings viewers into cold water and then orders them to stay afloat. Part of the thrill of the movie, and many le Carré novels, is the thrilling sense of discovery, that moment when a little piece of information finally clicks and all of the pieces start falling into place. Many thrillers attempt to build excitement by allowing the audience to watch as the characters slowly discover information we had found out about long ago. This one builds excitement by allowing us to slowly catch up with the characters. It's a movie which requires the viewer to lean forward and engage with what's happening. Fortunately, the film rewards our attention with precise, unwaveringly well-organized direction, which allows us to feel that we're in good hands. The movie, which offers a story about a spy attempting to find out about a mole within his organization, benefits from a host of fine British actors, populating even the smallest of roles, with Gary Oldman leading the charge as central character George Smiley. There's a great moment midway through the film in which we hear a line of dialogue which has been uttered in countless movies over the years. "We're not so different, you and I." It's a line which is usually delivered from the villain to the hero. But it's the protagonist, Smiley, who utters those words in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. In Alfredson and Le Carré's icy Cold War world of deceit and impersonal treachery, it can be difficult to distinguish the heroes and villains amidst all the shades of gray. The film's sharp left hook of a climax simultaneously reveals the full extent of the film's chilliness and the surprising depth of its empathy, leaving us as disoriented emotionally as the film's opening scenes left us disoriented narratively. That just about wraps things up on the program for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us again next week for more music and movie reviews. Have a great week, everyone. Back at you later. Maybe you have lost your